Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Once again, joining us is Robert Kleinhens. He's the chief economist of Kaiser Center for Economic Research. And they conduct research on regional, state, and national economies. Dr. Kleinhens has a bachelor's degree from the University of Michigan, a master's degree and doctorate from USC, all in economics. Prior to joining LAEDC, he served as deputy chief economist at the California Association of Realtors and taught economics for over 15 years, most recently at California State University Fullerton. Robert, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on your program, Bruce.
You know, I kind of just recently poked around at looking at a refi and got quoted a rate that I just barely can understand. It was under 4%, something like 3 7/8 for a 30-year mortgage. And I go back only 30 years when I became an investor, and I refinanced my house at the time to get the money to do that. And it happened to be perfect timing, 1981, and I paid 17.5% fixed.
Boy, what a difference a few decades makes, and maybe a couple of recessions in between.
I mean, it's just astonishing. And I wonder if you're 22 and just starting out, if you're thinking that this is in any way normal, to where you're only accustomed to seeing something that starts with a 5 or a 4. And I wonder how different the future will be of that particular rate is going forward.
Okay, so you compared what happened back in the early 1980s to the interest rate situation today. And if I were to place a bet on what's likely to be more normal in the foreseeable future, it's the interest rate climate of today, not that of the early 1980s. In the early 1980s, we had very high rates of inflation. We had an economy that was in transition. It was stagnating in several sectors for several reasons. But the main thing was that we had a lot of inflation, partly driven by high oil prices. And that, in turn, led to high interest rates. And do keep in mind that the Paul Volcker-led Federal Reserve Bank undertook efforts to bring that rate of inflation down. And one of the ways it did that was by increasing rates to make it very difficult to borrow. So that was a much different climate. Hopefully, economists have learned a little bit about keeping inflation in check, and hopefully policymakers have listened to the economists who talk about it. And I think we're going to continue to stay in an environment over the next few years that either has low or moderate inflation, not double-digit inflation.
I'm going to try and quote this correctly. I read this somewhere. It says, experience is that thing that lets you recognize a mistake when you make it again. And so, you know, what's interesting about not being concerned about the people that are in charge of policies is their opinion of how benign the housing problem was going to be. That bothers me.
I would admit that policymakers are humans like us, and sometimes they don't get the information right, and then sometimes they still make poor judgments. And so we definitely have to be concerned about the fact that mistakes are made on the policy side, just as mistakes were made on the business side of things that gave rise to the situation that we face today.
If you don't fear inflation, are you concerned at all about deflation?
Well, it's not that I am not concerned about inflation. I just do not expect to see high levels of inflation over the foreseeable future. And that is predicated on, again, going back to your point about policymakers and their ability to make the right decisions. It actually hinges on the ability of the Congress to come up with a credible plan to take care of these federal deficits over the long term.
Exactly. Somebody has to be interested in a bond that the risk level seems appropriate with the return. And what's interesting, we had just talked about it off air, the one-year T-bill in Greece is paying 402% as of yesterday, which would probably give you an idea that you probably shouldn't invest in it.
Right.
You're not going to get your principal back.
And so the likelihood that the United States would find itself in the same position that the country of Greece finds itself in is very, very low.
Absolutely.
So I don't think we want to be too alarmist here. I want to point out that there is a very real possibility that we may face a debt situation. However, there are several moving parts there. And fortunately, I suppose, for us right now, the ace that we in the hole that we have here in the United States, and we spoke about this earlier, is the fact that the U.S. dollar is the reserve currency, and our treasuries tend to be the flight to safety for so many investors around the globe when things go awry elsewhere.
That I didn't know how profound effect that would have. Because that's exactly what happened when you talk about a 10-year T-bill. I think most of us would have anticipated seeing something under 4% was pretty astonishing, and then it got under 2%.
Oh, absolutely. And if someone hasn't already refinanced their house...
Yeah, what are you waiting for?
you definitely need to be sitting up and taking a look at rates today because those rates are fundamentally driven by what's happening with the yield on the 10-year Treasury, which... nobody would have expected that it would fall below, say, 3 or 4, and here it's been consistently under 2 for quite some time. So,
and all of that, again, courtesy of something that's really outside of our borders.
Part of that, of course, also stems from the Fed's commitment to maintain low rates over the quote-unquote foreseeable future through the middle of 2013. So there was also that policy move. An effort to ensure that long rates stay low, partly to help the housing market, and more generally, I think, to get people, investors, to, say, pay attention to the stock market where there would theoretically be better returns, et cetera, et cetera. So there were a number of angles behind the Fed's move, but that has served to also keep rates down.
And how does the Fed ensure that that's sort of in their control? What do they physically do?
It has a limited ability to do this because if the market moves in a big way, it may not be able to buck that trend, but it does accomplish that end by buying securities or selling securities in such a way as to maintain rates at the levels that they're targeting at this time.
So we pretty much have a zero Fed fund rate. We have under 4% mortgage rate. If we were to have an issue, let's say, where the Eurozone went into a pretty tough recession, would there be a domino effect here that could possibly kick us into another recession? And what bullets are left in the event that happened?
Yeah, I think the wild cards that we're looking at in 2012 include the situation happening in Europe. And if their economies weaken there is some concern that we've already seen some of those economies tip into recession, that could jeopardize the situation here in the United States. We're out of the recession. We're growing. We're actually now in the expansionary phase coming out of the recession. So that could definitely temper the growth or lead to a stall out in the economy here in the United States. Now, that's the economic linkage between the European economies and the U.S. economy. The other linkage is the financial linkage. So if the sovereign debt problem in Europe, not just Greece, but Italy, possibly in France and elsewhere, give rise to problems with banks, not unlike what we had a few years ago at the height of the financial crisis, then that could stymie activity in the financial world once again. And as a result of that, that could, of course, have a feedback effect on the real economy and also either slow the growth pattern of the U.S. economy or perhaps tip it into recession. So you have two things coming out of Europe that have the potential to either slow down or derail our current expansion.
When the United States had defaults on the mortgages and the mortgage-backed securities and the CDOs, that had quite an effect, a direct effect on the people that invested in that, the banks over there. This is a little bit different in the sense that I don't know that there's many. Does the U.S. have much of the investment there, or is that mostly contained inside of their own banking system?
Well, it was incestuous, I guess you would say.
Yes, so, exactly.
Right. So there are flows of capital that go across international boundaries through commercial banks. And so if there is a problem that shows up over there, it may also show up on the balance sheets of banks over here. And so it's through that particular conduit or channel that we would perhaps see problems occur. I would think, I'd be very surprised if we have something as calamitous as what we saw in 2008. So much has changed since then, but I think that there is a possibility. And to look at this situation in the financial sector, we have to recognize that so many financial decisions rest on some confidence of what is going to be some outlook about the future. And so if you lack confidence in the future, or if you just don't know, then you're unlikely to make a decision. Or you may make a decision to do nothing. So the problem with financial crises, such as we went through in 2008, is that they have long-lasting effects. They wreak havoc on consumer and business confidence. Then they lead businesses as well as households to sit on their hands until they get a sense that the coast is clear.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is actually one of the reasons why this recession was so deep and continues to be as long as it has been. There's a real concern about the outlook, and it's reflected in consumer confidence and business confidence that just hasn't really shown marked improvement over the last couple of years.
Is there real concern about the oil world and their, challenges amongst themselves? Do you fear anything about, closing the strait or anything like that, aggressive? Or do you just think that's probably going to be a benign year in the oil world?
Well, if we take a step back to 2011 for a moment and we think about all of the wild cards that played out in 2011, a number of them are actually still potentially playable in 2012. So we talked for a moment about the European debt situation. That is actually a wild card that has been played several times over the past few years. The Greek debt crisis being the one that seems to be the wild card that is played most frequently. And then if you take a look at the Arab Spring, that gave rise to disruptions in oil, the flow of oil, and gave rise to higher oil prices. And there's always the chance that something in the world of energy that triggers an increase in the price of energy, oil or otherwise, there's always the chance that that could either slow down economic activity, if not derail a growing economy. The other wild card that we have to contend with in 2012 that we also dealt with in 2011 was political. And this year, of course, the big political wild card is what will happen in November with the election.
Mm-hmm.
So it does appear as though we're going to continue to be stepping carefully through 2012, hoping that these wild cards don't wreak too much havoc on the economy, because if they do, then they have an adverse impact on confidence, and if there's an adverse impact on confidence, then the growth we anticipate just is not going to materialize.
In the employment sector, how important is construction to the improvement of the unemployment?
It's an important segment of the economy. It's essentially flat on its back right now here in California and elsewhere around the country. If you look at residential activity, say permits in the state of California, they're just a fraction of what they were in years past, and they've been at this very low level, just a fraction of any long-run numbers for the last few years. But it makes sense, because if so many foreclosed or distressed properties are available for sale at a fraction of the cost of new construction, Not that they're exact substitutes for each other, but there is a sort of a broad market for housing where distressed property values are probably way down on other properties. it's going to be some time, you know, until that backlog of distressed properties gets substantially moved before we see on the construction side of things, before we see construction pick up in a noticeable way. Same way with commercial construction. There are a lot of very high vacancy rates, especially for office buildings these days. Less so for retail, certainly much less so for industrial. Industrial is actually in Southern California is outperforming many other markets around the country.
Yeah, I noticed that. It has less than a 5% vacancy factor.
Right. So it is very much a mixed bag, but I would say that construction is going to be recovering slowly. And meanwhile, let's take a step back. In a general sense, the labor market seems to be at a turning point where in order to produce more in 2012, it seems very likely that employers are going to actually have to add people, not just ask their existing labor force to work longer hours. So there should be a general upturn in employment in 2012 compared to 2011. It's just a question of how much of an upturn. We need probably somewhere around 300,000 jobs added per month across the nation in order to bring the unemployment rate down in a noticeable way in a reasonable amount of time. But the most recent report, the one for December, showed that we added 200,000 jobs, which was a great number based on the recent history.
Yes.
It's just not a high enough level of growth to bring the unemployment rate down. At 200,000 jobs per month, it could take 4 or 5 years for us to get down to a 6% unemployment rate nationally. At 300,000 jobs per month, it would only take about a little less than 2 years. Huge difference.
Which path do you think is likely?
At the present time, I think we should be banking on the 200,000 jobs per month or thereabouts, barring any of these wild cards being played.
Mm-hmm.
And then if that happens for a few months' time, then we might actually see the economy gain some ground. But the sector that's in the driver's seat here is the consumer sector. And consumers are weighed down by uncertainty about their jobs and their economic outlook, the fact that their assets aren't worth what they had been worth, and the fact that they may have some credit constraints. Access to credit may not be what it had been, certainly with respect to buying homes. So all of those things are constraining growth in consumer spending, and that's really the main thing that we need to look for in terms of the driver behind the overall economy. If consumer spending picks up, then we're going to see job gains pick up as well.
And looking at a chart for mortgage equity withdrawal, in the years where, let's say, 2002, 3, 4, 5, maybe 6, it was responsible for an awful lot of GDP growth. And that driver is certainly been diminished, if not, you know, eliminated from most people's possibilities.
Sure, that's absolutely true. I think as we go forward, it's certainly going to be the case that the American consumer is still going to have a place for the use of credit. May not have access to the same amount of credit that was available when they were able to use their home equity in order to finance so many things. Certainly that is the case. But and I suppose that's not a bad thing, right? Because it does seem to have created problems, especially problems that have spilled back into the housing sector. So we don't want to go back that way, but we do expect to see that some loosening of credit access on the part of consumers would probably enable the consumer sector to get a little bit more steam and give a little more push to the overall economy.
The problem with shadow inventory, what's your thoughts on that? You know, I guess, well, first of all, what do you consider that shadow inventory? What does it contain? You know, that definition of shadow inventory has changed over the last couple of years. So what do you feel is the shadow inventory and maybe the best resolution for that?
The notion of shadow inventory, I think it's useful for us to get a sense of how long we're going to be dealing with large numbers of distressed properties. And so if we use that as the definition and we ask, well, okay, what are things going to be like, say, 2 years out? Well, the shadow inventory that I would use at that to get a handle on that particular question, it would be the inventory that's on the books, if you will, let's say MLS-based inventory for existing homes plus unsold new homes. And the unsold inventory for existing homes in the state of California is about 5 months inventory. So let's just put that number out there for a moment. 5 months inventory is enough to actually sustain increases in prices, not decreases in prices, because the average is about 7 months. So we're under 7 months if we're at five. But then we go through the foreclosure pipeline, and the first thing we would pick up would be the number of REO properties that are held by banks in inventory. That's equal to maybe another 2.5 months or so of inventory. So now you're getting over 7 months. When you take the five that I mentioned earlier, you add 2.5 months. Then there are properties that are scheduled for auction, also maybe another 2.5 months inventory. But the timeline for that is a much longer timeline. The REO properties, you know, from the point in time they go into inventory, it might be about 6 months or so before they're actually prepped and sold. So the relevant shadow inventory number to use for current market conditions, to understand what's happening in the current market, is probably MLS-based inventory plus new homes plus REOs in inventory, which actually is some double counting, but just roughly speaking. If we're talking about asking the question of how long this is going to be with us, we're going to go further up that foreclosure pipeline. We pick up the properties that are scheduled for auction. We pick up the properties that are in a pre-foreclosure state. So either an NOD or notice of default has been filed, or a property is maybe delinquent. You're talking about another 2.5 months inventory. This is simply by taking the number of properties that are in pre-foreclosure state, which is about 100,000, and looking at that relative to total annual sales.
Mm-hmm.
And you also have to look at the timeline. So an NOD that is filed, let's say, in January of 2012 is probably about 18 months away from going into the REO inventory. So 18 months from now, and those numbers, by the way, are roughly 100,000 in REO inventory and roughly 100,000 NODs plus delinquencies at the present time for the state of California. So...
And by the way, that time frame is not anywhere close to normal.
Absolutely. The statutory time frame is what? About 6 months.
Three weeks plus 3 months.
Right. Okay. So things, because of different kinds of policies and so on, that timeline has, of course, been stretched out, and a number of problems that the lenders have encountered or servicers have encountered along the way. But the bottom line is that as we are going further up that ladder and we're actually including more and more things in this notion of shadow inventory, and we figure out, well, how long is it going to take to push all of these properties through the foreclosure pipeline and out through the existing home market and new home market, we're looking at 2014 in all likelihood before things will be getting closer to normal levels of distressed properties.
Okay.
I think the housing market's going to feel like it's recovered before that period of time, but we're going to have substantial numbers of distressed properties working through the housing market over the next 3 years.
We've got a little less than a minute. One of the things that I think is a headwind that I hadn't really thought of, but in Riverside, for instance, 62% approximately of the sales are either short sales or foreclosures, which means that when you sell 1,000 homes, only 380 buyers emerge. Everyone else is credit damaged. So that's going to take a while to heal. Robert, why don't you give me some information on your website in the last 30 seconds as far as people taking a look at the Kaiser Foundation?
Yes, if you would, please check out the LAEDC, Los Angeles County Economic Development Corporation, at www.laedc.org, and you'll find out about our annual forecast event that will be happening this February the 15th here in downtown Los Angeles. I invite you all.
And is that something somebody can go and buy a ticket and see?
Yes.
Okay. Well, Robert Kleinhans, thanks so much for joining us. Very informative, and enjoy talking with you.
Thank you, Bruce.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.